communism. 1937. Now, I think I said to you the other day that it took Pius XI quite a while to realize that the communists were fooling him and to take the measure of communism. In other encyclicals, especially Leo XIII says that liberalism paves the way for communism. You might say makes the bed for communism, they say in French. Because liberals get rid of God, and atheism is the key to communism. Liberals and communists are kissing cousins. And Pius XI had a bit too much of the practical liberal in him. He wasn't theoretically liberal, again, like Leo XIII. There's a bit of the practical liberal in him, and therefore he didn't see through communism as he didn't see through communists as he should have done. However, he did learn, and by 1937 he realized what they were up to, and therefore came out with this tremendous condemnation of communism. It's suitably colored pink. Should be flaming red, of course. Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. This time it's a long encyclical. It's not complicated. It's not really complicated, but it is long. All of you do read it. I think the numbering is the same this time. Yeah, I think the numbering is the same. It may be an official numbering. So, of the Divine Redeemer, he begins with an introduction on the first side of the page, and then you've got, of course, remember that the popes always do this. They go for the principles, and therefore you get communist doctrine, paragraphs 8 to 24. You then get Catholic doctrine, 26 to 38, as opposed to the communist doctrine. In other words, the truth after the lies. Then you turn over and you get section 3 is the application of that Catholic doctrine. What's needed in order to get the Catholic doctrine out into action. And then section 4 is the persons to apply that doctrine with a brief conclusion at the end. Of these sections, it should be obvious that the communist doctrine is the most important. I mean, the Catholic doctrine is the most important as far as the truth goes, but as far as this particular era goes, it's the communist doctrine. It's interesting that the communists themselves pretend not to be doctrinal. The communists say, oh, it doesn't matter all about all this, but just come along with us and do what we do. Help us to look after the poor. Because they know that if somebody just begins acting like a communist, they'll finish up thinking like a communist. But nevertheless, their action is very much based on a clear doctrine. The essential thing to get hold of about communism is that it's a false religion. It's a substitute religion. It's got a religious dimension. It is in fact a messianism. It's a messianic system. So you can guess who's behind it. The people who know the Messiah, who knew the Messiah, and who were meant to know, meant to receive him when he came. They're behind this because they've got that capacity to conjure up a vision of salvation. Communism is a vision of salvation. It's a, in its brutal form, it's kind of over. I said kind of over, since 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. But communist principles haven't changed. It's part of communism that its tactics can change at any time in order to deceive the enemy and in order to continue to promote the revolution. If the revolution is blocked here, well, we'll simply take a detour, go round and continue. But they are very consistent about where they want to go. Where they want to go is to get rid of God and create paradise on earth. And therefore, communism is a kind of naturalism. They don't want God. They don't want supernatural paradise. They don't want anything supernatural. All they want is, we men are going to do it on our own. We men are going to do it better than God has done. God doesn't know what he's doing. We're going to show him how. And we are going to rewrite human nature. We're going to rewrite, reconstruct human society. We're going to reconstruct paradise. And we're going to do it here on earth, where it's for real and practical, as opposed to pie in the sky. That's communism. And it rests upon the premises of materialism and liberalism. Man is free to do as he likes, and all that exists is matter. So, it's very close to liberalism. It follows directly from liberalism, which is why all of those liberals in Washington during the 40s, 30s and 40s, under F.D. Roosevelt, they basically loved the communists. F.D. Roosevelt handed half of Europe on a silver plate to Stalin. They loved the communists, and they hated the conservatives who got in their way. And they demonized Joe McCarthy. And they demonized Nixon. Because Nixon, as I think you could see last in this movie, Nixon had that Protestant, that Quaker decency. There's a Quaker decency in the man, which made him stand on the side of those old Christian values. He may even never have formulated them as Christian values. I don't know if Nixon ever spoke about it. I don't know if Nixon ever even used the word Christian. But what he's standing for is, in fact, those values against communism. And so Nixon, quite a bit of him is green, so to speak. I doubt if he ever thought of Catholicism. But in any case, he's defending those values without really knowing what he's doing. And he's defending them again, but at the same time he shares in these democratic ideas. And so Nixon is torn apart. He's confused. A man confused because, again, he mixes Catholic ideas with liberal ideas. And because he's a man divided, he will fall victim to the men who are not divided, the liberals who are not divided. Those vile journalists, those vile politicians, those vile and miserable rats in Washington, the 60s and 70s and 80s, or 70s especially, who will do anything to bring down somebody who stands in their way. So, what Pius XI is talking about here is the kind of extreme form of communism. But this communism is very close to American liberalism. American liberals are very close to this in their ideas. And the new communists, the globalists, are just mutated from this. The mutation is an interesting one to study. They did mutate in order to get round the blockage that Ronald Reagan had kind of brought into being. The West had kind of blocked communism, and Russia could go no further forward because it just didn't have the money to spend on the weapons and so on. So they mutated. And now the West has dropped its defenses, the West is dismantling its military. And of course there's that famous quotation of a Russian politician, thinker, way back in the 30s, we will launch a great peace offensive, we will get the West to drop its defenses, and then just when the West is thoroughly unready, we will come in and smash them with a clenched fist. Manuel's cutting, that's right. I think about the 1930s. It's perfectly possible. Russia today is under the control of a conjunction of the mafia, the Russian mafia, that's gangsters, and the KGB. The KGB is still very much in control, I think, in conjunction with the mafia. And the old communists also. The old communist leaders, the KGB, and the mafia, they're very much in control. And it's perfectly possible that Russian public opinion, the Russians are proud. And they don't like being overrun by McDonald's and General Motors and all the rest of it. As far as they're concerned, that's materialistic trash, as far as many Russians are concerned. And it's perfectly possible that there's going to be a tremendous swing of Russian public opinion back to Russian nationalism, Russian pride, Russian military might. And it might not take very much for the whole of Russia to get on its military feet again. And there's a lot of those weapons still there, which the KGB most likely can control. And our media, of course, lie to us. There's no way of knowing what's going on from our media. No way. Pius XI will say that. That one of the reasons, paragraph 18. The press is keeping on communism a conspiratorial silence. And that is, of course, because the Western media are all in the hands of the same people as are behind communism. These messianic people who are intent upon destroying Christianity, destroying the Christian Messiah, and replacing the Christian Messiah with their own Messiah, which is the chosen people. They, who have a right to world control, who have gifts by which they deserve to dominate and to completely overrun the goyim, the stupid goyim, and therefore, they bought up all the newspapers here in the United States. They bought them up steadily in the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. The stupid goyim allowed all of their newspapers to be bought out by these people. And so the stupid goyim, ever since then, have had their minds run for them by these people. Why? Again, because of a vacuum. There's a great hollowness. You've got a Western nation without the Catholic faith. And that there's a great gulf there. There's a great vacuum just waiting to be filled, and it's filled by another messianism. And people today, why do people buy the vile media? Why do decent people continue to trust these vile media? Because the vile media give them a vision, give them a purpose, give them a crusade. We're going to get rid of colonialism, get rid of fascism, get rid of the police, Rodney King and so on. We're going to get rid of all of this miserable old control, and we're going to bring in a new world order, which is going to be dazzling. People buy it. People have to feel they're going somewhere. So, in a way, Divina Redemptoris is out of date, but the beast is essentially the same. He's mutated, and you'd need a good pope would write another encyclical on how the beast is mutated. You'll never get that encyclical out of John Paul II, because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand the problem at all, because he believes in a lot of what's behind this. But and it took Pius XI a while to understand the problem. Finally, he did. So we're not going to get, in the immediate future, a pope to write an update of Divina Redemptoris. But back then, of course, communism, the clenched fist was in operation everywhere. They were smashing everybody. I mean, they were into Spain. What finally woke up Pius XI was, I think, the terrible civil war in Spain, when the priests and nuns were slaughtered and raped and so on and so on. The convents and monasteries were burned to the ground. The church underwent a horrible persecution. And I was just in France a little while ago, and I was reading some of the things that the French Catholic intellectuals were saying at that time. And it's unbelievable what some of them were saying. So, you know, I mean, the priests and nuns are being killed and so on, the convents and so on are being destroyed, and the French Catholic intellectuals are saying, can't the church mediate between the two sides? Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Here's the church being slaughtered, and the church has got to mediate between herself being slaughtered and her slaughterers. Dear slaughterers, please only half slaughter us. I mean, it's incredible, the blindness of these liberals. The liberals are blind. It's a terrible punishment from God. So, I don't know how many of you now know Whittaker Chambers' Witness? How many of you have read Whittaker Chambers' Witness? It's an old generation. The three of you are a little older. No, Otherwise, the book's just gone down the memory hole. Whittaker Chambers was another decent American, confused, but intelligent and courageous and on the side of the angels, not knowing really what he was doing. I think he converted before he died, Whittaker Chambers. I think he became a Catholic before he died. But in any case, the whole Alger his story, oh wow. But Whittaker Chambers was a journalist who in about 1930 went into the Communist Party. He was a very intelligent young man, wasn't Catholic, but he studied history, he studied Western civilization. He could see that there was a big crisis. He could see that the First World War hadn't solved the problem, that there was going to be another World War, that the modern world is in an impossible crisis and there's no way out. And in 1930, he chose the way that a number of other bright young men chose to solve the world's problems. He thought communism would do it. And so he became a communist. By the end of the 30s, the great purges in Russia, 1937-38, Whittaker Chambers came out of communism. He realized that it wasn't what it cracked itself up to be. He had difficulty getting out of communism, because the Communist Party don't like people quitting who've been serving them no more than the Masons. He lay low, I think, for about half a year. He had to lie low for his life. But then, since he surfaced again, and he became a small-time journalist. And the Communists probably left him alone because they guessed that he wasn't going to denounce them or shout or yell or what. So all right, they left him in peace. They could have killed him at a later stage, but they didn't. So. Then after there's some problem with this Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss was a liberal rat, a darling of Washington, a darling of all the liberals in the Democratic government administration of Roosevelt, a smart man, but a complete rat. And he helped write the Charter of the United Nations. He was right up at the top of all of these liberal communist left-wing intellectuals. He was right up at the front of the pack. I forget exactly how the clash arose, but Alger Hiss and Whittaker Chambers, I forget how it started.
It was the Dyes Committee. Martin Dyes had this subcommittee, House subcommittee, on House investigation of un-American activities. And Nixon was a member of that Martin Dyes Committee, and that's how the...
In any case, Alger Hiss testified, and Whittaker Chambers said he was a liar. And so it came to a trial of Alger Hiss for perjury. There was a full-scale trial. Was Alger Hiss telling the truth or not? All Washington, all the media were right behind Alger Hiss. And only the little people and those who hated communism were behind, were with Nixon and Whittaker Chambers. It came to a trial, and the high point of the trial, as they reminded us in the movie last night, the high point of the trial was when Whittaker Chambers said, well, back on my farm in Maryland, I've got some celluloid film which proves, it's got Alger Hiss's writing on it, it proves that Alger Hiss was handing documents to the Russians. So there was a sensational excursion to the pumpkin patch in Maryland. How many of you have heard of the famous pumpkin patch? See? The pumpkin patch was part of... Every American knew about the pumpkin. But today it's completely disappeared. It's gone down the memory hole because nobody today wants anybody to remember that leading liberals are lying rats and that Whittaker Chambers was a hero. That's got to be forgotten. So the whole episode has just disappeared from the memory of the liberals, and it's disappeared from the history books, it's disappeared from education, and it's disappeared from the media. Whittaker Chambers is a hero, a real American hero, and it's a classic. His book, Witness, is a classic. It's full of history, it's well written, it's full of drama, it's full of love of America, and so on and so on. So, in any case, they went down to the pumpkin patch, they opened up the pumpkin in the pumpkin, and sure enough, there, Whittaker Chambers had hidden this film. He knew he'd have to hide it, because otherwise some communists would come through his apartment at some stage and steal it, and then he'd want to look for it. He had to hide it, so went down, sure, and Alger Hiss was convicted. The court was honest enough to convict Alger Hiss. And apparently, Whittaker Chambers and the good guys triumphed. But of course, the media just sort of immediately began wiping out the whole affair and forgetting it. And Alger Hiss was sort of rehabilitated and made a hero again, and so on and so on and so on. But this book, Witness, is the story of Whittaker Chambers' autobiography, in particular the story of the Alger Hiss case. And so in order to describe how Whittaker Chambers knew that Alger Hiss was a communist, Whittaker Chambers describes how he himself got into the Communist Party. And there are very interesting pages in which Chambers talks about the reasons why he became a communist. Very, very interesting. It's section 3, The Outrage and the Hope of the World. I won't read it to all because it's too long, but it all needs reading. And what he says is, he says, civilization is in a serious crisis. 1997, still serious crisis. Sooner or later, one of my good friends is sure to ask me, how did it happen that a man like you became a communist? Each time I cringe, not because they're asking me a personal question, but because they're failing to grasp the fact that a man does not, as a rule, become a communist because he's attracted to communism, but because he's driven to despair by the crisis of history through which the world is passing. Whittaker Chambers still says then, this crisis is twofold. Notice he's got a materialistic mind and he sees the problem in materialistic terms. The two challenges, the problem of war and the problem of economics. That's not it. But that's how he sees it. What's behind the problem of war and what's behind economics? Behind economics is politics and behind war is what people are believing in. So, when an intellectual joins the Communist Party, he does so primarily because he sees no other way of ending the crisis of history. In effect, his act of joining communism is an act of despair, regardless of whether or not that is how he thinks of it. And to the degree that it is an act of despair, he will desire the party to use him in overcoming that crisis of history which is at the root of his despair. You see, he will desire the party to use him, and a man like Whittaker Chambers will be ready to sacrifice everything in order to help civilization to overcome its crisis. What should Whittaker Chambers have been, anybody? He should have been a Catholic and a Catholic priest and a Catholic martyr. That's what he should have been. Because he's got all of these considerable qualities he's putting at the service of a crusade, a victory, a hope and a vision. That's what he sees. That's what communism was for him. But it's a crusade and a vision resting upon materialistic premises. There is only matter, there's no such thing as God, there's only matter. There's only matter and men. So, nor do Marxist dialectics or Marxian economic theories have much to do with the reason why men become and remain communists. I have met few communists who were more than fiddlers with the dialectic, which is the intellectual tool whereby Marxist theoreticians probe and gauge history's laws of motion. I have met few communists who I thought knew more than the bare rudiments of Marxian economics or cared to. But I have never known a communist who was not acutely aware of the crisis of history, whose solution he found in communism's practical program, its vision, and its faith. That's it. A practical program, a vision, and a faith. That's the wrong order. It's a faith, a vision, and a practical program, in fact. It's the other way around. But that's what it is. Communism is a substitute religion. It's a substitute crusade. It's a substitute vision. It's a substitute hope for materialistic people who no longer believe, and because they're rotten materialists, can no longer believe. Well, I wouldn't say rotten materialists. Because they're trapped in materialism, they can no longer believe in anything spiritual. And therefore they've got to see it in materialistic and economic terms. Therefore we've got to liberate the people from economic suffering. We've got to pull down the upper classes. We need class warfare to level everything out and make everybody prosperous and materially equal and happy. The revolution, it is in the name of the will to survive that communism turns to the working class as a source of unspoiled energy which may salvage the crumbling of the West. Remember, aristocracy, middle class, lower class, trees, seals, ozone. This communism is the lower class turning against the middle class, because the middle class is just materialistic and has no vision and no values. When the Latin American police used to fight the communists in the jungles of South America, and when the police closed, or the army closed in on a gang of communists and shot them down, and when they looked at the corpses to find out who they were, do you think the corpses were corpses of peasants? Who were they corpses of? College kids. Sons of doctors, sons of engineers, sons of architects, sons of lawyers. In other words, the idealistic young middle-class men who are rising up in revolt against their father's lack of vision and lack of spirituality. The fathers are contenting themselves with swimming pools and prosperity, and the sons are saying, that's not enough for a human being. A human being needs a vision. Who can give me today a vision that I can believe in, a better and nobler future for mankind? And apparently the answer is only the communists. And on a basis of materialism, it's only the communists. And these young men don't think of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is out of it.
Couldn't this kind of stem out the universities where we are power children?
The universities have been full of communism for a long time, for the same reasons. The communism, in the universities you do not have men with any Catholic faith, or very few. And they're materialists. They're materialists and they're liberals, and if you're materialistic and a liberal, you are 7/8 of the way to being a communist. And the universities were full of materialists and liberals, and that's why the communists have taken over the universities. Because communism is just pushing materialism and liberalism just one stage further. That's all it is. So, you may remember, how many of you, the film The Graduate, how many of you have seen the film, the movie The Graduate? Well, you may remember. This young man who's just come out of a university, he may or may not have been taught communism in the university. But here he's a little bit goofy, and he's at the cocktail party for his degree, or his graduation, and his parents are very proud of him, and they've got a lovely swimming pool, and they bought him a black frogman's kit, you remember? And they show him off in the frogman's kit, and he comes out flopping with his huge feet, and looking totally goofy, and everybody applauds while he's behind this god. Very cleverly done. And at the cocktail party, remember, there's a man. There's a serious, undoubtedly CEO, chief executive officer of some big company, who says, young man, I've got something serious to tell you. At last, somebody is going to take my degree, take my life, give it some purpose and direction. So the young man is all ears and gog to listen to what this serious, dark suit, impressive, lantern jawed, tan, good looking, successful hero is going to tell him. So come aside, young man. Oh yeah. So they come aside. They move away from the drinks and the clatter. Young man, everything I have to say to you can be summed up in one word. This is going to be the key to the universe. This is going to be the solution to life's problems. This is a future. This is a hope. This is a wonderful thing. He just can't wait for this one word. And the great man draws himself up to his side. He says, my boy, plastic. Plastics. The poor boy just... And this is all that materialistic liberal society has to offer to a young man in the way of future, purpose, values and dream. Plastics. That young man is liable to go off to the jungles and start fighting with the communists. If all that the most serious, intelligent and admired people, adults in his society can offer him is plastics, he'd rather go off to the jungle, or he'll go off to Frisco and become a hippie, if necessary a gay, in order to shock these adults out of their world of plastics. Who on earth can think that human beings are made for plastics and that the purpose of the universe is plastics?
It's almost
true today. Well, that's it.
What is it, plastic?
Yeah, everything is plastic. Plastics is the future. But I mean, for goodness sake. The rest of the film, movie, but that scene is worth it. The movie is worth it for that scene alone. It's very well done. So what Whittaker Chambers is saying is, hey, plastics is not enough. And I went off and became a communist because I was looking for something more to solve these deep and serious problems of civilization. I needed something more than just plastics. He says that he went all around the university, listened to everybody, he studied, and there was no answers. He says, the revolution is never stronger than the failure of civilization. Communism is never stronger than the failure of other faiths. Communism is simply the, when you get a tree that rots, fungi, all kinds of mushrooms and fungi grow on the stump of the tree. If the tree is in health, the fungi just can't grow on it. The tree has to be rotten before the fungi can get a grip. A healthy tree, the fungi get nowhere. Communism is a fungus growing on the rotten trunk of what used to be Christian civilization. And communism is no stronger than the weakness of Christianity, which is the weakness of Catholicism. Because Protestantism is already a serious weakening of Christianity. Therefore, and the just like we were saying the other day, a Jew who really converts makes an excellent Catholic. Communists who really convert make excellent Catholics because they've got all the drive, they've got the intelligence, they've got the dedication, they've got the willingness to sacrifice themselves. And with Chambers, it's just a shame that he... But the poor people today, the faith is so far from them. It's so difficult to imagine that the Catholic faith might be true. It's just unimaginable that... So, it is the crisis that makes men communists. It is the crisis that keeps men communists. So he went round Europe. He saw the galleries and museums with a Jewish friend. And he saw the vast cemeteries of World War I. He saw that it was a ruin. And then he comes back and studies. And I turned to the United States and I plunged into socialism. He thought socialism might be the answer. But he found that socialism was dry and it was lifeless. And it wasn't real. And then one day he brushed it all aside. Socialism is not the answer. It was perfectly clear to you that if socialism was to stem the crisis and remake the world, socialism would involve a violent struggle to get and to keep political power. The Webbs, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, made no provision for getting or keeping power. On the other hand, I had a profound antipathy to force. I didn't like violence, and so I was glad to shelve the whole problem. I returned to Columbia College to major in history. One day, by sheer chance, there came into my hands a little pamphlet of Lenin. It was called A Soviet at Work. In a simple, strong prose, it described a day in the life of a local Soviet. The reek of life was on it. This was not theory or statistics. This was socialism in practice. This was the thing itself. This was how it worked. I quickly passed on to Lenin's State and Revolution and the ABC of Communism, whose three authors were all shot during the Great Purge. But here was no dodging of the problem of getting and keeping power. Here was the simple statement that terror and dictatorship are justified to defend the socialist revolution if socialism is justified. Terror is an instrument of socialist policy if the crisis is to be overcome. It was months before I could accept even in principle the idea of terror, but once I had done so, I faced the necessity to act. And so he becomes a communist. He enters the Communist Party. The dying world of 1925 was without faith, without hope, without character, without understanding of its malady, without the will to overcome it. It was dying, and yet it laughed. The laughter was not the defiance of a vigor that refuses to know when it is whipped. It was the loss, by the mind of a whole civilization, of the power to distinguish between reality and unreality because, ultimately, although I did not know it, this civilization had lost the power to distinguish between good and evil. You remember the syllabus? God doesn't exist, and therefore there's no difference between justice and injustice, good and evil. It's right up number one of the syllabus of errors. And this is the fruit of those liberal errors. A whole civilization which can no longer distinguish between truth and untruth, between good and evil, between justice and injustice. And Chambers can't stand it. He just a courageous, intelligent, and young man wishing to do something can't stand this rotten decadence. This failure I too shared with the world of which I was a part. The dying world in 1925 had no answer at all to the crisis of the 20th century. And when the crisis was mentioned, and when every moral voice in the Western world was shrilling crisis, it cocked an ear of complacent deafness and smiled a smile of blank senility. Throughout history, the smile of those for whom the executioner waits. There's a death sentence on Western civilization. Absolutely true. Only in communism had I found any practical answer at all to the crisis with the will to make that answer work. It was not an attractive answer, just as the Communist Party was not an attractive party. But neither was the problem which had called it forth and which it proposed to solve attractive. But it had one ultimate appeal. In place of desperation, communism set the word hope. If communism was the outrage, it was also the hope of the world. In the 20th century, it seemed impossible to have hope on any other terms. It's just so well said. It's a classic. Of course, since then, since communism is now discredited, young men like Whittaker Chambers today, where do they turn? They turn to drugs. They turn to globalism. They turn to... What else do they turn to?
If I can just make a comment. When that book came out, I don't remember the publication date on it, but it must be about 1949.
Something like that.
It was so popular to show the difference between the general attitude toward public life and politics and so on today and as opposed to then. It was so popular that the libraries could not keep those copies of that. Yeah. I remember myself actually signing up to be on a list in line for that book.
1952. Yeah. Interesting that it was when it came out then very, very popular. But today, you know, things have just gone down and down. In the 50s, there was still some strength and some courage and decency amongst in the American people, no doubt about it. But the liberals have worked around it and undermined it and corrupted it ever since. And there's not much of that left. There's still some of it left.
About 18 months ago, a biography of Chambers was published that's very favorable and really takes on your history.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The truth does sometimes.
The truth does sometimes get out, yes.
Is there anywhere we can get that book? Is there in the library?
This edition is Regnery Gateway. It may still, this is a recent edition, it may still be published and obtainable from them.
If they go through a used bookstore for Goodwill Solid Shanghai, you come across tons of them.
Yes, there we are then, a used bookstore. It's a classic. It's a classic.
You can buy it for 50 cents.
Yes. Yeah, that's probable. Then that is what communism meant to a brilliant and brave young man, a brilliant, brave, and decent young man. I don't want to sanctify him, but I mean, he did have some very good qualities, that's obvious. But he didn't have the faith, and he didn't have even a glimmering of the faith. Because of all of this, since Henry VIII, 400 years of Protestantism, which have just blanket smothered the Catholic faith.
He came out of communism before his next hope.
Interesting question. When Whittaker Chambers came out of communism, he said, when I ceased to be a communist, I knew that I was joining the losing side. I knew, and he said it was very difficult because he left a hope and a vision and a crusade for no hope or vision or crusade. He knew it. You want to read what he himself says about it. There's another volume, Order to Regnery Gateway, Letters to a Friend, the exchange of correspondence between Whittaker Chambers and then William Buckley in the 50s, who was a better man than he is now. And it's called Letters to a Friend, I think, or Odyssey of a Friend, something like that. And it's another interesting book. And Whittaker Chambers had no alternative hope. He just knew that communism wasn't the answer, so he had to get out. Because he was a decent man, and communism, he knew by then, was totally and radically indecent, and therefore it wasn't the answer. But he walked into nowhere, and he says, yet a kind of instinct, it's just an instinct, like in Nixon, it's just a blind instinct of goodness which still comes up and says to him, I've got to fight communism, and I've got to pull down Al-Jahis, I've got to help to pull down Al-Jahis if I can. And he, in his letter to Buckley, he says, why did you do that? And he says to Buckley, simply because, I don't know why, but I knew that communism was wrong, and I wanted to give civilization an 11th hour chance. I wanted to give it I wanted to help to give it a little more time, but that's all he's got. People can't live without hope. And it's a very good question to ask, what was his alternative hope or vision when he came out of communism? He didn't have one. And that's why it was difficult to get out of communism, as he himself said. Because he had nothing to go to when he came out. And yet, he decided to witness to the lie of communism and the lies of Al-Jahis in order to give decency a chance to prolong the reprieve. But he knew the execution was still waiting. And he didn't really have a hope. And it's only Catholicism. These poor fellows, they've got to go back to Catholicism. Otherwise, there's nothing. Those of us that are here, we have the immense advantage of the Catholic faith. We can solve these awful problems. These problems are otherwise insoluble. Absolutely insoluble. Of course they're insoluble. These problems arise because human beings who are made by God, for God, with a dimension of God. The dimension of God is that we're meant to go to eternity and fill our minds and our wills with God for all eternity. These beings who are not made for plastics, who are made for much more than plastics, these beings can see nowhere around, anywhere, what satisfies that. And therefore, they'll grab hold of anything to fill, to satisfy this tremendous hunger for a vision and a greatness and a nobility and a hope and a future and a crusade. They'll grab hold of anything. They'll grab hold of politics. Nixon tries to make politics fill the vacuum. Nixon's mother must have had huge influence. There was a brief newsreel shot, and it was clear she had there was something in her. I mean, she wasn't, when she says, I'm proud of all my children, that's a little off target. But nevertheless, there's a strength there and something spiritual even. Quaker, but nevertheless something spiritual. Nixon must have very much loved her and admired her, and he finds a good woman to take her place as his wife. He just zeroes in on a good woman. That's the strength of the man. And that's the strength of the United States, is whatever is still left of the good old-time Protestant religion. And whatever's good in the old-time Protestant religion is whatever still hangs over from the Catholic religion that went before it. That's the only strength. And that's all on, that's the green side of Nixon. And then mixed in with it is all of this poison about, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness and materialism. But the strength comes from the old-time religion. And as you say, the family structure, because the family did hold together. And families were holding together. But today, the families are shot. I forget Whittaker Chambers' family. I think he was born on Long Island. I forget what his father was. And I think the family hung together as families tended to. He got something solid from somewhere, and a sense of decency from somewhere, and stood by it. And I think he converted before he died.
I think he was a convert of one of Fulton Sheen's converts.
Fulton Sheen,
Louis Boudin's, Ellen Gurley Brown,
yeah.
And a few others. And I think he was one of those ex-convicts at Fulton Sheen.
He married a Jewish. Whittaker Chambers married a Jewish wife whom he loved dearly, who he met in his communist days. I'm pretty sure, and she was a very good wife to him. But poor people. So let's have a look at what the Pope says about communism. It's a Catholic problem. Only Catholics can understand communism, because only somebody who understands Christ can understand the Antichrist. No economist or materialist can possibly understand what the Antichrist is about. And no economist can understand what the Jewish people are about. Only a Catholic can understand the Jewish people. Because only a Catholic who knows the real Messiah can understand the vacuum in the Jewish people with which the poor Jewish people try to, the vacuum which the poor Jewish people try in multitudes of ways to fill by making themselves into the Messiah of the human race. and providing the human race with an anti-Christian alternative salvation. That's communism, and it was, of course, Jews substantially behind communism. Whitaker Chambers wasn't a Jew, but he didn't launch communism, but those who launched communism were in large, overwhelming majority Jews, which is true to type. Poor things. Introduction. Communism of the Church. The coming of the Redeemer brought a better age for all, Christianity, but the devil's continual revolutions threaten worse than ever. Notice how often the popes mention in these encyclicals up front the series of revolutions which are overthrowing civilization. One revolution like one bomb after another, you may remember, down the chart. Now Bolshevism aims to tear up Christian civilization by the very roots. Bolshevism was the name for Russian, the outbreak of communism in Russia in 1917. Pius IX and Leo XIII have wisely and accurately condemned communism. We ourselves have often spoken out and been condemned for doing so. Yet the danger continues to grow. We must speak out again. So we've got communist doctrine, Christian remedies. Communist doctrine is the most important. Gentlemen, if you go away from this with nothing else, go away with a belief in dogmas, ideas, and principles. Please. They are important, which very few people today believe or understand. The theory of communism, secondly the power, and thirdly its results. Notice he will contrast Catholicism, again the theory, the power, and the results. 26 to 38, you can see the same game plan. So he contrasts communist theory power results with Catholic theory power results. Communist theory, which again is the basis of the power and the results. The theory. So 8 to 14 are the most important paragraphs of the whole encyclical. In general, in particular, and the verdict. In general, 8. Communism is an alluring offer of false salvation to the poor. Communism is a salvation. It's got that religious appeal, that religious attraction, that religious dimension. It's alluring, it's tempting, it's deceptive, it's presented under very beautiful appearances, it's going to save the world. That's how it appeared to Whittaker Chambers. It's going to save civilization. And Whittaker Chambers is not an idiot by any means. And communism appeals to intellectuals. Then we go into the principles. Notice 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Notice the order. God starts. You're starting with God. Man, family, society, and state. Same order. The doctrine of communism on God. Then the doctrine on man, taken individually. The doctrine on family, the doctrine, communist doctrine on society, and communist doctrine on the state, with finally a verdict. That the key to the whole of communism is in paragraph 9, God does not exist, but only matter. Communism is a form of materialism. The Westerns today are hugely materialistic. They are 9/10 communist, right there, already. They're all ready to be taken over by communism. Yes, it's communism. It's materialism.
They don't.
Of course they don't. They're blind.
But the communist leaders know.
The communist leaders know that yes. Yes. God does not exist but only matter and evolution and the class struggle. The communists very much admire Charles Darwin and very much believe in evolution. Because they use evolution. Evolution is a way out of God. The world will happen all by itself. Evolution explains things. In the beginning was evolution, and evolution created the world and the evolution, etc. And the class struggle. That's all they believe in. Yes?
Some eyewitness believe in evolution. The car doesn't come from the Jews, and the Jews still have their rituals and whatnot.
Charles Darwin was a Gentile. And I don't think Jews, I don't know of Jews being responsible for the doctrine of evolution, perhaps, but I don't know of it.
Well, the question, or point would be, is they love the evolution to take away from godparents on the materialistic realm, but yet they still have their rituals and they pray to their Old Testament Jehovah. So there is a God. In the same sense, there is no God.
Well, the communists use evolution. They very much use the doctrine of evolution. Evolution is pushed in the schools. It's pushed ever since the famous case in the United States in the 1920s in Tennessee. The Stopes case, was it, Charles?
Charles Stopes.
Right.
Did they misquote the Pope when he mentioned evolution?
I don't think they misquoted him, no.
And you really felt that as possible?
I think so. They tried to, there was a reaction and they tried to cover up, but he believes in evolution. Yeah, he believes in evolution, which is just incredible. But, so notice that. 9 is the most important paragraph of all the encyclical. Does God exist? Does God not exist? That's the bottom line in every system. God does not exist, declare the colonists. Only matter, evolution, and class struggle. The class struggle is simply evolution amongst human beings and human societies. One class clashes against the other. There's a synthesis. This is the Hegelian system. Then there's a new break-off, a new clash, a new thesis and antithesis, a new synthesis, and so on. So it's evolution amongst human beings. Consequence, since there is no God, then the spirit, there's no spirit. Syllabus error number 1. There's no such thing as spirit. Therefore, man has nothing spiritual about him. Therefore, man has no freedom because matter is determined. Man has no dignity. He's just a bundle of chemicals. Man has no rights. What sense do rights make in terms of matter? Man has no authority. We're all just equal bundles of chemicals. And he has no property. Therefore, all of the old-fashioned teaching of man which structures society, his rights, his authority, property, just wiped out, vroom, because that's all spiritual or semi-spiritual, and there's nothing except matter. We're just bundles of chemicals. Therefore, freedom, dignity, rights, authority, property, forget it. We move on to the family. Since there's no such thing as spirituality, there's no such thing as a sacrament, of course. There's no such thing as God. There's no such thing as God, man not pulling asunder what God has put together. There's no God putting together. Then marriage is purely a civil contract. Woman is to be emancipated. There's no such thing as hierarchy between man and woman. They're just two different bundles of chemicals, slightly differently arranged, but otherwise they should be absolutely equal. There's no reason why the woman should be under the man. Woman is to be emancipated, and the children are to be educated by the state. Because parents have no rights. There's no such thing as a special bond between parents and children. There's no such thing as a family structure. This is communism. And this is teaching, this is what most Americans today, I think you would agree, believe.
Well, it's a United Soviet state.
The media are pushing down people's throats the idea that there's no difference between man and woman. A woman, I saw a picture of women boxing the other day. Somebody sent me through the women boxing. Insanity. Women's sports are insanity. When the women are even half undressed, if there's any man around watching, the women even half undressed, it's insanity.
You see the women
dressed? Well, at least they're ugly. But I mean, there's a terrible problem with women's sports. Accustoming the women to undress and to jump up and down in public in one shape, size, or form. It's absolutely wrong. Perry?
That women boxing is actually at the military academies.
Is it?
Yeah, it's in our military.
Incredible.
Forcing them to take boxing.
Incredible. It's crazy. But that's this doctrine. Since we're all just bundles of chemicals, this is a female bundle of chemicals, this is a male bundle of chemicals, that's the only difference. There's just a slight difference in biological function. There's no other difference. That is not Catholic doctrine. That is not Catholic doctrine.
St. Mary's College won an award from the state this year because of its women's sports program.
St. Mary's College won an award from the state down the hill here because of its women's sports program. These poor people are pushing in this crazy direction. Society has all the rights. Law and morals have no stability because if we're all just bundles of chemicals, then the only thing that's superior to one bundle of chemicals is a bundle of bundles of chemicals. In other words, only numbers of a whole lot of people together. In other words, the state. The only thing that has any clout over me as a bundle of chemicals is the collectivity of the bundles of chemicals. That's society. So therefore, society has all rights. Law and morals have no stability. Back to the syllabus. Because law, you may remember the syllabus, one of the areas of the syllabus, human law does not need to be in line with divine law. Human law does not need the backing and power and sanction and clout of divine law behind it. Morals and law have no stability because they've got no God, no divine law, no eternal law behind them. God has no future. Forget about God. And so until the state withers away, it is the all-powerful instrument. Since society is the only thing, if I get rid of the spirit, get rid of God, get rid of anything spiritual, the only thing that's left is the bundle of all human beings taken together, in other words, the society or the state, then the state is the all-powerful instrument. All power goes to the state, as Lenin, it was Lenin's slogan, all power to the Soviet, all power to the state, with the dream that when the communism has succeeded in establishing itself, finally the state will be able to wither away, and then we will have paradise on earth. So this absolute dream of the state withering away so that everybody will be free, equal, and without any authority above them. Except for themselves, but I'm not above me, I'm at my own level. I am my own king, everybody is his own king. And there's not even the state, because, yes, it's chaos, obviously. It's insanity, it's complete insanity. Verdict 14. All of this doctrine on God, man, family, society, and the state is contrary to reason, it's contrary to revelation, it's contrary to the true nature of society, it's contrary to the true nature of the state, it's contrary to the true nature of the human person. It's contrary to anything, any kind of sanity. And yet this sheer insanity has gripped the large part of the human race and is in the process of gripping the United States. Because the United States is practically communist today. Mr. Tate.
How do you have a collectivity without some kind of society?
See? Answer. The state is going to be the all-powerful instrument until everything is so happily and organized, so in sync with communist ideas, that the state can afford to wither away. There won't need to be authority in the end. It's a dream. It's a dream. Mr. Perry?
Because it denies original sin, like all liberalism.
Yes.
And therefore, since men are basically good, to
yes.
set up the proper structure, they won't need authority because they will all be good.
Yes. That's it. That's the answer.
But that's not practical.
It flies in the face of the facts, but it's a dream. It is a dream. It's a utopian dream. Communism is powered by a dream, and it's a sick, dangerous, a deadly dream. We'll pick up again at 11.